I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama sends his jobs plan to Congress today. Then he'll hit the road to make his case to voters in Ohio and North Carolina. But as Washington struggles to create jobs, the country's largest lender, Bank of America, today announced 30,000 layoffs. Kevin Roos writes for the New York Times blog Deal Book. Kevin, anxious investors were waiting to hear what Chief Executive Brian Moynihan would say this morning in a conference call after his somewhat disastrous speech to investors in August. How do you think he did? Because he didn't even mention the layoffs in that hour-long conference with investors.
Sure. Well, I was puzzled. I thought, you know, and I think a lot of investors were expecting him to draw more concrete plans for this bank's turnaround project. And then an hour after he walks off the stage, the bank announces what would in journalism be called the lead, the 30,000 job cuts. So I was puzzled. I think he did a much safer presentation. He made almost no concrete details available to the investors. And so I think, you know, it's a somewhat bizarre choice of a rollout of this announcement, but I think the effect will be the same.
Which is what?
Which is that, you know, investors are now sensing that this process of turning this bank around, it's a process that's been going on for more than 6 months. It's called Project New BAC, which is their stock ticker symbol, is going to be a painful one for, in some ways, for the bank.
Well, Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan did say today that the company is performing well, except when it comes to its mortgage business. That's a big except.
Right. I thought that was sort of like, you know, well, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play?
Well, let's explain why. Bank of America acquired the mortgage lender Countrywide just before the housing bubble burst. Countrywide, of course, was just filled with toxic mortgages. And so the company is burdened with not just bad mortgages, but investors like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who bought those mortgages, are demanding that Bank of America buy them back because of the way they were written.
Right. Well, Countrywide has been sort of an albatross with an albatross hanging around it. It's saddled with these bad mortgages, and it's led to a number of legal problems for Bank of America as they attempt to unwind this. Fannie and Freddie, as well as some private investors, are saying, you know, hey, wait, we bought these mortgage packages under the assumption that they were better than they were. We got bad data, and so you have to buy them back from us. And this has been an ongoing process. Tons of lawsuits in the pipeline right now. And so a question for Bank of America is, you know, how do you prepare for that? How much money do you set aside to pay out potential settlements? Brian Moynihan talked a little bit about this today. He said basically we've priced all of these settlements in. Nothing has been unexpected, and we've got the capital to deal with anything that should come up in the future.
Bank of America is also dealing with a robo-signing controversy. The bank signed off on foreclosures without doing due diligence, and they're paying off a $8.5 billion settlement on that issue. How is what's happening at Bank of America affecting the average American?
Well, Bank of America, as we all know, is the largest bank in the country. It's got almost 300,000 employees. And as you mentioned, the president has just unveiled a new jobs plan that is supposed to grow the working class. So I think it's not a situation in which it's a one-for-one parallel, but in some cases, as Bank of America goes, so goes the country. So I think we should all be very concerned with how the bank does. And I think this process, which is supposed to go until next March, will have a lot to do with, you know, how strong a position Bank of America has going forward.
Well, you say as it shores up its business, and we see 30,000 layoffs, there's talk of shutting over 700 outlets, Bank of America outlets. So is that also a metaphor for what the country might be looking to, you know, more layoffs? Or might Bank of America just sever one of its limbs? I mean, it was asked if bankrupting Countrywide was an option. He didn't rule it out.
Right. He said, well, we have options on everything, and we're looking at all those options. What Bank of America is saying is, in order to grow, we have to shrink.
Kevin Roos writes for the New York Times blog Deal Book. With the news today from Bank of America, 30,000 layoffs expected. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you.
Today we want to take a look at boys and school. Boys are far more likely to be held back a year, far more likely to be suspended and to drop out altogether. And as a result, women are now the majority in college, holding 60% of all bachelor's degrees. In fact, colleges are looking for ways to attract male students just to keep a gender balance. Now, we know girls hit speed bumps in education as well. We know the stereotype. Initially, boys hate school, girls love it. Then when they get older, it reverses. Girls either dumb themselves down or are sidelined by a system that favors boys. But our next guest says great work has been done re-engaging girls as they get older. Now it's time to help the boys when they are young. And she says we can start by letting them be boys. For instance, she points to research that parents may be familiar with. You can ban toy guns, but boys will make one out of a stick, so why not let them? And far more controversially, why not let them bring their video games into the classroom? Ali Karchelman is professor of education at Penn State University. She joins us. And professor, of course, we know there are boys and girls who don't fit neat categories, but start with this research that you say makes things particularly tough for boys right now.
So there are three main things that I think are really becoming problems for us. The first is that we have fewer and fewer male teachers. We used to have about 14% in the elementary grade level, and in the last decade, that's been cut in half, which means 93% of the classroom teachers that our boys get are going to be women. And that sends a certain message. They don't necessarily have the sense that school is a place that men are or are successful in. Mm-hmm. It also tends to change the dialogue that's happening in the school. If there aren't very many men around, then when we decide how we're going to deal with somebody who's roughhousing on the playground, it changes depending on whether you have men in that conversation or not in that conversation.
Right. What are the two other things you've noticed?
A sort of misapplication of zero tolerance policies. The message that is being sent is that a lot of the things that boys are attracted to or interested in, things like weapons, for instance, they're not allowed to have in school, which makes sense. I don't want to suggest that we should be encouraging kids to bring weapons to schools, but when we get to a point where a kid can't bring in a plastic fencing sword or something to demonstrate his fencing lessons or to show his Halloween costume, then maybe we've gone a little too far, and this tends to, again, give boys a message that they don't belong. And, you know, we've got some pretty good evidence that psychologically this is all very normal. And so the notion that we're saying you can't play cowboys and Indians, you can't play any of those kinds of violent games, really is difficult for most boys of a certain age to accept. It's not part of their normal psychological makeup. They should be allowed to have those kind of fantasies because that's normal for them. And it's part of how they learn to be grown-up men, too, I think. So you're right. I'm not pushing for allowing more bullies or somehow reifying masculinity or something, but rather really trying to encourage us to open our minds to the idea that maybe it would be okay to have a little bit looser interpretation of some of these regulations so that a boy's culture could be accepted in schools. And that's really what I think we're talking about.
You say it's stronger than that. I want you to get to your third point, but not only that the culture of boys isn't working in schools, but the way boys exist doesn't work in schools.
Yeah, that's right. They exist in ways that are active and at times violent, which is okay. Now, not all boys exist this way, but lots of boys exist this way, and lots of active girls exist this way, too. And schools are not places where that existence is respected.
Okay, so the third way you've observed this.
Curriculum compression is probably among the biggest. So we really want our babies to read at 18 months. So what's happening in kindergarten now is what you or I might have experienced in second grade when we were in school. And that means there's more sitting down, more standards, more testing, things that just don't match well with boys. And that's gotten worse in the last decade also. Those are the three broad areas. And there are lots of possible ways to handle this. There's doing more kinesthetic learning, putting yoga balls in classrooms so that kids can move a little tiny bit every time they readjust themselves instead of feeling like they're locked into a seat and a desk. So there are lots of ways of thinking about it. Games are the one that I particularly became interested in and chose.
Well, that brings us to one of your controversial suggestions, using games. And in a speech you gave at TEDxPSU, which is one of the TED Talks that are held across the country, this one at Penn State, you, for instance, reference Nick Ferroni, a social studies teacher in New York City who uses The Simpsons and The Family Guy in his teaching,
right.
A school that uses World of Warcraft as curricular material.
What's been really interesting to me is that lots of people buy the argument, right? They look at the statistics. They see that for every 100 girls who are diagnosed with ADHD, 500 boys are diagnosed with the same problem. So we know that we've got this problem, and mostly people accept the premise. And then I get to the possible solution of gaming, and I get a real wall put up. And what's interesting to me about that is when I try to explore that a little bit further and find out, well, why is it that you don't want video games in your classroom? And mostly it comes to things like they're violent, they're competitive, they're individualistic. But what is interesting to me is that that's the very reason why I push on games as opposed to something that may be a little bit less controversial, because those are aspects that we might say embody boy culture. There's a reason that boys like these games. That's why I go to games. It gives us a relief point to say, are you really rejecting the games, or are you really rejecting boy culture?
Let's get to some of the rejection of games. Some researchers are worried that if games are brought into the classroom, it'll just become a babysitter, that they're too abstract for some younger children, that kids are supposed to learn how to socialize in school, and if they're all sort of locked on their computers, they're missing out on that socialization. And then I know you know of the research, there's so much of it, but you can pick some from Tohoku University in Japan. They found that children who spent hours playing games didn't develop their frontal lobes, which play such a critical role in controlling behavior and developing learning and emotion. And this comes as there are researchers like Richard Whitmore, who wrote Why Boys Fail, and Michael Gurian in The Minds of Boys, Saving Our Sons from Falling Behind in Schools and in Life. They both argue that boys' brains develop later and differently than girls. So if that's true about boys' brains, and then on top of that you add gaming, which might further stunt their brain development, that's the concern.
That's a reasonable concern, and I think that we should be paying attention to all of the kinds of issues that you're raising. Giving a game as a babysitter or lacking in socialization, that doesn't have to be the case. Certainly it can be, but what we find actually is that a lot of the multiplayer games and the really rich narrative games are ones that actually develop a huge amount of leadership, empathy for what's happening around them. So it actually, I would argue, has a lot of very significant benefits. And James G. has made this case far better than I certainly can.
Well, actually, we've come across that research as well, that kids use computers differently than adults do. They make
it
a social thing. They do it together.
They do, yeah. They do it together, but also they persevere in ways that we tend not to.
But just address the other concern, that it's damaging for their brains.
Well, I think that one of the things that you need to be careful of is that there's a lot of different research, and it's pretty, at this point, undetermined. So a lot of what I was seeing in James G's work and in some other people's work is looking at the question, especially around violence and violent tendencies after having played an aggressive video game. The few studies that we have tend to suggest that that is the case. And so that is a criticism and something that we definitely want to watch out for. And again, I'm not advocating for bullies or out-of-control classrooms, but we also need to take it with an understanding that those are very few studies at this point, and that many of them measured immediately after the game playing as opposed to over a long period of time. So if someone plays a game on Monday, are they likely to hit their sister on Wednesday? That's something that they really haven't been measuring very effectively in the research to this point.
We're talking with Ali Carr-Tellman, professor of education at Penn State. She says, historically, boys liked school, but then schools changed and no longer welcomed boy culture, their physicality, their love of technology. Now, we know not all boys like or can afford video games. Many girls love them. But Professor Carr-Tellman says it would greatly benefit boys to bring them into the classroom. Games like Club Penguin, which is sort of creating a second life only with penguins, or games like World of Warcraft, Civilization. Ali, Professor, very controversial, but you've looked at these games and you say that some would be terrific for classroom use. Why? What's your thinking?
I like to say start where your kids are. So if your children are really interested in Club Penguin, think about how you can use Club Penguin in your classroom. Civilization is a really good one for use in world history in particular, and it's being adopted in lots of high school curricula and really is very effective in terms of teaching people how to understand a lot of variables that go into making a society, like trade and war and products and religion and all those kinds of things that come into play. But something like World of Warcraft, for instance, becomes really interesting when we start talking about race relations, because there are all these different races and they have different kinds of gifts. But learning World of Warcraft takes a long period of time.
Yeah. Well, some of the other games that you talk about, Journey to the Well, Divine, Dimension U, Generation Cures, that's another one that is, you know, social and civic responsibility. Players enter a story about a plague that's spreading across a mythical land. You know, where's the teacher in this? Don't you need a teacher?
Yes, absolutely you need a teacher. The role of the teacher is to try to draw out the lessons from the game. Now I'm designing a civilization. What kinds of things should I take into account in terms of religion? I don't know what these various religions are. Maybe I should study each of these religions and understand better what they are, which are in conflict, things like that. And so all of a sudden, then you're going back into the curriculum and working it that way.
And what have you seen this do for boys in particular?
We communicate to them that they belong, that this is an okay place for them to be.
How will this help in their literacy? Will it?
Yeah, it's actually amazing. The research around literacy and gaming has been very interesting, and Constance Steinkuhler has done some really interesting work around how boys and girls who are considered delayed readers are doing when they're given whatever choice they want of reading material and when the difficulty level isn't controlled for. Those children can read 3-4 grade levels above where they're reading, eliminating their label as a struggling reader. When you give children reading material that they're actually interested in, as opposed to what the teacher is interested in, or as opposed to what the school district or the state has told us they should be interested in, they do very well.
Stay there for a second, because I shared with you that I have a nephew. We're trying to get through Tom Sawyer.
Yes.
And he, you know, he's so bright, he's struggling a little bit, and finally the other night he said to me, it's just so old-fashioned-y. What are you saying? Do we give up on the Tom Sawyers so that they can read the liner notes from a video game?
Well, liner notes, maybe not, but actually there are a lot of books and online guides and things like that. And what's interesting is that kids can read that material with a 93% accuracy and extreme perseverance because they really, really want to know.
Kids want to eat more ice cream than spinach, too, you know?
So, right. You know, when we go to suggesting that games are like ice cream and Tom Sawyer is like spinach, I would like to say I don't necessarily think that that's an accurate or fair portrayal of games, because really to engage in a game and to do well in a game, you have to work very, very hard. And so if you find a child who's really engaged in their gaming at that moment, you'll see a child who's intent, focused, all the ADHD things that we worry about are gone. So that doesn't mean that we need to give up on our classics, but we need to understand that the classics may not seem relevant to a child unless we somehow bring them into relevance. And that means we've got to work hard to do that.
Well, and bringing it back to boys, how much do you address their need to be physical, which isn't allowed? What to change there? What to do there?
There are lots of interesting ways that we can think about addressing that, but they don't fit very well in the current school structure, which really is about sitting still and doing paperwork more than we might like. The hands-on things usually do pretty well for active learners, whether they're boys or girls. So most active kids do pretty well in science because that tends to be more hands-on. But, you know, building things, for instance, that's just not something we do enough of in schools today. But you'll talk to a parent of a child who has ADHD, and they'll say he does really, really well in Scouts. That's not surprising, because a lot of what's happening in Scouts is not sitting and listening. It's out collecting leaves and building things and shooting arrows. I'm not sure what the precise answer is. What I've decided is that I'm not willing to give up on school yet. Some of my colleagues are fond of saying schools are done. We lose that 6 hours. We need to figure out how to work with all the other time that we have, how to get them in after-school programs, how to get them in Scouts, how to get them through church school, how to get them in all these other places, because we lose them for the 6 hours that they're in school. And if we really want to do something dramatically different in terms of their learning, we're going to do it not during school. I'm not willing to give up on schools yet.
Get rid of the old paradigm of let the boys, and the boys that we're talking about who don't like school, let them sit through 6 hours of school, and then they go get to play football.
That's right. And they feel good about themselves because they have a place that they succeed and they're confident. Yeah. And sometimes that can slosh over into school, which is great when it happens, but it doesn't happen all the time. The other alternative is that they withdraw into games, and that kind of withdrawal can lead to the kind of game addiction that's really problematic. So actually, in some ways, putting it into schools is probably the best way to make sure that we don't have as many game addicts, because as soon as you put something into school, they say, oh, that's no fun anymore. So
It's fascinating. That's Ali Carr-Shellman. She's professor of education at Penn State University, talking about boys who statistically are having more and more trouble in school and her thoughts on how to change that. And by the way, we want to note again that you participated in studies of girls and are now paying attention to boys. It's not as if you've picked a side here.
No, absolutely. I am a feminist. My husband is a feminist. And when we had twin boys and put them into school, we were a little surprised by what we discovered, actually, in our own experiences. And that somewhat led us to understanding some of these problems more. But I think that we do need to continue to pay attention to girls in schools, and especially in middle school, math, science, engineering, and college. We also need to take a page from that playbook and say, we've done a really good job with girls. We've made good strides. Let's figure out what they've done well and make sure that it happens for boys in the elementary schools.
Ali, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Well, they're going to have to play a let there.
Well, she shouted in the middle of that shot. The ball had not landed, and she was saying, come on.
She should play a let.
Did you see it? Serena Williams belting out, come on, as she belts the ball at Australia's Samantha Stosur at yesterday's U.S. Open. And while the commentators thought maybe Serena should do a do-over because of the shout, chair umpire Eva Astaraki gave the point to Stosur. Then Williams really let it rip, shaking her finger at the ump, saying things like, you have it out for me, in a scene reminiscent of her tirade 2 years ago after a line call. Then Williams had these words for the umpire.
Really, don't even look at me. I promise you, don't look at me.
George Vesey of the New York Times joins us. George, go to the very beginning. What is this rule the chair ump said Serena Williams violated when she yelled, come on?
The rule is that you can't make an act that distracts the opponent, even if unintentional. And in fact, what I didn't realize last night was that there was a comment in the USTA rules, in the tennis rules, to that, which says that even if it was unintentional, if it served to distract, then that is worth a point.
So a lot of sort of casual tennis fans in our office, well, actually, we have very fierce tennis fans, are asking, what's the difference between the grunts that players do and the come on?
It's a good question. Up to now, the interpretation is that the grunts are part of the mechanics of hitting. The words themselves could be heard in a different way. If a player is reaching down to hit a hard smash by Serena Williams and she hears the words, come on, that is, to me, a more specific distraction.
Well, now, Serena Williams said afterwards in the press conference that she thought it would be the hat drop rule, which is if your hat falls off or something, you get to play the point again. Do you think that there is confusion about these rules on the parts of players? Let's just start there.
Well, the hat drop rule is unintentional, even the act. I mean, putting the hat on your head and then having it fall off is not intentional. You didn't mean for the hat to drop off. Whereas a spoken word, that I certainly do not think that Serena was trying to distract her opponent. But because it was in the point of the ball zooming in at Stosur, that it was intentional to say it, even if the impact was not intentional.
And as you write, the umpire, Eva Astaraki, had some leeway. You know, it's a subjective call, but let's just put the rule aside and go to the behavior. What do you make of the flare-up? What do you make of Serena Williams, you know, pointing the index finger, pointing the racket at the umpire later, and the words, aren't you the one who screwed me before? What do you make of that?
I would say it reveals the Serena Williams underneath that facade, that bland giggle and, I'm just the star and I'm secure in my own world, that under that there is a level of anger and unpleasantness that frankly rivals that of some of the players. I mean, people say, well, what about McEnroe and what about Connors? Nastassi taking poor Frank Hammond out of the chair back in the early 80s, this great chair umpire. I mean, we've seen a lot of nasty behavior by men also who certainly have an antisocial streak to them and didn't mind using it one way or the other. Serena's right up there with them.
And so what? What does it mean in the final analysis? Do you think it's why she lost?
No, absolutely not. She was not going to win that match anyway, in my opinion. We could all see she was not hitting the ball well. When she finally did hit the ball twice, I can certainly understand her blurting out, come on. She just happened to blurt it out a second too soon for her own good. I can't blame her for being mad. It's what bubbled out afterward. It's the anger at somebody else saying to the official, aren't you the one who got me the other time? And, you know, of course, she's totally wrong about that because this is a Greek woman, and in 2009 it was a Swedish woman. When we asked her after the match, she was back to that giggling ingenue, like, oh, I really don't remember. I was in the heat of the zone. I just prefer to think I was competing. It's the other side of Serena, like she's contemptuous of us, that she doesn't even have the responsibility to give us a mature answer. She can't do that.
George Vesey, the Sports of the Times columnist of the New York Times on Serena Williams' loss to Samantha Stosur in yesterday's U.S. Open. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for calling.
You probably remember former New York State Democratic Congressman Anthony Weiner, who earned the title former after tweeting pictures of himself to a woman who was not his wife. Weiner was a fierce defender of President Obama's health reform. He took Charles Schumer's congressional seat after Schumer went on to become a senator. His former district in New York, the 9th, parts of Queens and Brooklyn, is heavily Jewish and solidly Democratic, which is why tomorrow's election to replace Weiner is causing hearts to quicken on both sides of the aisle. The latest poll shows that the Catholic Republican former cable TV exec Bob Turner is 6 points ahead of Dave Weprin, the scion of a Democratic political family and an Orthodox Jew. Grace Rao is covering the special election for New York One. Grace, we understand at the heart of the campaign is Israel. Which of these candidates supports Israel more is the question. So first, remind us how this happened. It had to do with former New York Mayor Ed Koch?
Exactly right. Former Mayor Ed Koch really changed the dynamic of this race early on in July. Former Mayor Koch, who is Jewish and a Democrat, made it clear that he was interested in supporting the Republican Bob Turner in this race, specifically because he wanted to send a message to the White House that folks like him and other Jewish voters in New York were unhappy with the direction the Obama administration was going on Israel. Specifically, they were upset by President Obama's call for Israel to return to the 1967 borders, for that to be a starting point for a peace deal in the Middle East. And so former Mayor Koch crossed party lines and endorsed the Republican in this race, Republican Bob Turner, and did not endorse the Democrat, who, as you noted, is also an Orthodox Jew.
Well,
so a very strange set of circumstances.
Well, especially since Mayor Koch has said he's really not even opposed to Weprin's stand on Israel. Weprin has been to Israel 8 times. He's been under rocket attack twice while delivering bulletproof vests to Israelis. So it's not about the candidates themselves.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, it's become almost symbolic at this point, the idea that because this is a special election, only one of 2 special elections for Congress happening on Tuesday, that the whole country is watching what happens in New York and that the White House is watching, and that Jewish voters who are upset by the Obama administration's policies on Israel, they're going to get their attention. This is going to draw attention to this issue, and if anything, could potentially change White House policy. That's their hope, obviously.
Well, and the timing is incredible, given what the topic at the heart of the campaign has become, because Israel, of course, is very much in the news. The embassy in Egypt being attacked last Friday. In a couple of weeks, the Palestinians are going to defy President Obama in the United States and go to the UN to ask for statehood. We have the Arab Spring, which changes all the dynamics in the Middle East. So there's that sort of hovering over all of this. And there's also 9/11. Here we are on, 9/12, the election, 9/13. What role do you think 9/11 plays? Bob Turner, the Republican, lives in Breezy Point. They lost 32 of their 5,000 residents on 9/11, the New York Times writing yesterday. That would be the equivalent of New York City losing 51,000 lives. It's a huge hit to that neighborhood. And, the sense that this may be Democrats, but they're not liberal Democrats, especially post-9/11.
Right. These are not, as you said, liberal Democrats. Democrats vastly outnumber Republicans in the district when it comes to registration, 3-1. But just back in 2008, President Obama, while he did win the district, it was only by 55%, which was a smaller margin than many other areas in New York City. As one political consultant told me, this district is full of what she called dinos, Democrats in name only. Not a phrase that we hear that often, but these are more conservative Democrats. It's heavily Jewish. There's also a heavy Irish Catholic population, many firefighters, many people who lost someone. And in terms of September 11th issues, Bob Turner has tried to capitalize on a controversy which has largely died down in the last year, but he's tried to reignite it over plans to build an Islamic community center and mosque near the World Trade Center site. He has come out staunchly opposed to this project, denouncing plans to build it so close to the site of the attacks. David Weperin has been on the record saying that he may not love this idea, but there's a freedom of religion in this country, and the developers of this project have the Constitution on their side, and they have the right to go ahead and build it.
David Weperin saying that he wished the developers would choose another location further away, but again, they have the freedom to do what they'd like. And meanwhile, nothing, you know, that's a project that's sort of on hold. But as far as this election, this is taking Democrats by surprise because, as we understand it, they didn't really consider this important in that this might be a district that gets redistricted out of existence anyway.
Right. So there was a lot of political calculus at play, as there always is for something like this. But because this was a special election, there was no party primary to select the candidates. The party leaders, Republican and Democrats, got to handpick their candidate for this race. And David Weperin was viewed as a candidate who could win this, but not necessarily rock the boat after he won when redistricting came up, who isn't going to challenge a seated congressman in a neighboring district.
Who will follow the party mandate and kind of bow out when the district goes away rather than challenge another Democrat. So people are trying to read the tea leaves tomorrow. But Grace Rao, it seems as if this is a unique situation, having to do more with an Orthodox Jewish community, a post 9/11 community, both very concerned about security issues, more than, let's say, what the national electorate seems to be concerned with, which is jobs. Is this election really being seen as something that reflects the way the rest of the country is feeling?
Well, I think it's grown beyond those two issues, because now the message out of Bob Turner's camp is not just about Israel. It's about, hey, if you want to get the attention of President Obama, if you want to let people in Washington know that you're mad with what's happening, you're angry about jobs, about the economy, go to the polls and vote for this Republican. The idea being that you will never, as a voter, have another opportunity to speak directly to the president. That's a line that we hear a lot on the campaign trail.
And we understand turnout is expected to be low, maybe 20%. And when the number is that low, it's usually the case that the very angry and the very passionate are the ones who do come out.
Right. But the Democratic Party operation in New York City, it's incredibly strong and shouldn't be underestimated. Just even the teachers' union in New York City estimates that 11,000 of its members live in this district alone. So they are going to have a formidable get-out-the-vote operation. So these things sort of counterbalance each other. The polls, I think, reflect the feelings in the street, but whether people go to the polls is another question.
Grace Rao, covering tomorrow's special election in New York's 9th Congressional District for New York One. Grace, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Picking up sound on the interstate. I am my breath. Letting in waves.
In July 2008, this song, Go On, Say It, by the Portland, Oregon band Blind Pilot, was chosen to be a single of the week on iTunes. It propelled their debut CD, Three Rounds and a Sound, to the top 20 on Billboard's digital album chart, and NPR featured it on their Best Music of 2008. Then Blind Pilot appeared at a number of music festivals, including Coachella, South by Southwest, Austin City Limits. Now their sophomore CD, We Are the Tide, is being released tomorrow. Here's a bit of the title song.
Our time is ever on the road to ride. What we make, I want to hear how this give and take.
Blind Pilot will tour this fall to support the album We Are the Tide, though not this time by bicycle. More on that in a moment. As the band's founders join us from Oregon Public Broadcasting, we have lead singer and guitarist Israel Nebeker. Israel, welcome.
Thank you.
And also drummer Ryan Dabrowski. Ryan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And Israel, let's start with you. I love that song, We Are the Tide. Where'd it come from?
I was living in Portland, and one night I was rehearsing over at Ryan's painting studio, and on my way back on the bus, I just was sort of overcome with a really strange mood, feeling connected to everything and everyone. And then I stepped off the bus and turned the corner to my place and saw the lunar eclipse, which I didn't know was happening. I was just really struck by how much the moon could change my whole perception and my whole mood. Yeah. And the song came out of that. So
did you say Ryan's painting studio?
Yeah, I still do quite a bit of painting when we're off the road, but that was kind of my main thing before Blind Pilot. The two of us would play music all the time in there, and then once the rest of the band came into the mix, then it sort of became a little bit less of a painting studio and a little bit more of a music studio.
Right. And you mentioned the rest of the band. We should say you guys started as just the two of you. You met in college. We're busking in England?
Yep, that was kind of the whole beginning. We spent a summer running a summer camp in England, and then in the evenings we would go into town and just play music on the streets, and it was this kind of amazing way to connect with people in that town. And so when we started Blind Pilot, we kind of wanted to recreate a little bit of that energy.
You know, I'm thinking of someone listening to this who wants to have the success that you are having right now, taking notes and thinking, okay, so what I have to do is busk in England. No, I have to be a painter. No, I have to run a camp. And we should touch on the other thing that might be a good idea, touring by bicycle. How do you do that?
Small drums.
Yeah, tiny drums.
You do that with a very small drum set. I don't know. We didn't have much of a plan when we did the bike tour. The very first one, we recorded 5 songs and we just burned them on a computer, and I made a little block print and we printed some CD cases, and then we were just dropped off with our bikes and our gear in Vancouver, BC. And that's kind of how we did a bike tour.
We just saw how far south we could make it.
Yeah.
This is 2000.
It was San Francisco.
This is in 2007 when you had that bike tour. Well, let's just listen to some of the music and then talk more about it.
It was a wild idea to start. We were lost in an hour, everything came apart. In the middle of nowhere. Oh man, hey, look where we are.
You know, I'm thinking, bike tour down the West Coast, it all sounds so Portland.
It's embarrassing how Portland we are.
Well, but what else about you is Portland?
Katie, who is in the band, she and I used to work at a coffee shop.
That's very
Portland.
That's Katie Claiborne, who plays banjo, dulcimer, has some backing vocals. And what about the music? Israel, you in particular, I want to ask, because you have a lovely voice. And at times I'm hearing a little Bruno Mars, you know, at times maybe a little Chris Martin. There's that voice that's out there now, Chris Martin of Coldplay or even John Mayer. So who influenced you, and how do you break through further than you already have, given that there's this voice out there?
I don't know. I mean, I definitely had, when I was learning to sing when I was young, I had all the people that I was trying to emulate. I really wanted to sound like Billy Corgan of Smashing Pumpkins for a long time, and then Tom York? Of Radiohead came along, and that was probably, I'd say, the biggest influence on me until I went to school for voice performance, and then I sort of went my own way.
Well, back to the story of your group, Blind Pilot. You added, as we said, 4 new members. We mentioned Katie Claiborne. There was Ian Christ and Dave Jorgensen, Yitzti.
Luke Yitzti on bass.
Okay, so let's listen to a little more of the full-fledged Blind Pilot from their new CD.
Holy road, we are on tonight. Catch as catch can tell, we get it right.
this dark light.
There are other people who have taken this route. I'm thinking of Tracy Chapman, you know, from busker to big. Do you ever think, Israel, I would just love to go out on the street tonight and put a guitar case out and play?
Yeah, that thought crosses my mind quite a lot.
Daily.
No,
what'd you say, Ryan, daily?
Oh, I said almost daily.
And it's not that I'm at all ungrateful for that we get to play these shows to lots of people. It's wonderful. It's what we've been hoping to do for a long time. I think we just need to find our way of bringing whatever excitement that you have, you know, playing for people on the street and somehow incorporating that into our tours. Hmm.
That's Israel Nebiger with Ryan Dabrowski, the founding members of the Oregon band Blind Pilot. By the way, Ryan, Blind Pilot?
When we started the group, we were in Astoria, which is right where the Columbia River meets the ocean. And there's these pilot boats that go out to the large cargo ships that come in and out of the Columbia there. And on the side of these boats, it says pilot in black letters on these white boats. And I just really liked the way it looked. And I thought we should take sort of something from that place that we were coming from. And then I don't know why we put blind in front of it.
Yeah, it just seemed to fit with what we were doing on the bike tour. We were just about to go on the first one and didn't know how it was going to be. And it also seemed to work really well when Ryan painted signs for us. His said pilot and mine said blind.
By the way, did anyone mistake you for a blind person, Israel?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't. I can't believe we didn't even think about it. But I think a couple times people like pulled over to see if I was okay.
Yeah.
One time they were quite upset. They were like, "You're not blind.
Yeah.
You can't go around wearing that sign."
Again, Israel Nebiger and Ryan Dabrowski, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us. The stars wash over me so far away.